Hi, and welcome to episode 77 of Fully Boosted, a War Machine and Horde podcast. I'm Grant.
I'm Ryan.
I wish I was Grant.
I'm Pete. And tonight we are very fortunate to have someone who did way better at Adepticon than I did, Mr. Tim Banky.
Folks, how's it going?
Hi,
happy
Tim.
The cast. Not for the first time, and hopefully not for the last time, because there's some of my favorite folks to listen to.
We appreciate that. And Pete, I will give you half credit for that rip it yourself, so that's fine.
Yeah, don't worry. I'll do much better when we describe how bad I did at Adepticon.
Yay! Great. So Tim and Pete are fresh off Adepticon, so we wanted to get Tim on, and we were going to talk to Pete anyway. So, guys, I will just hand it over to you, but start wherever you want to with the Adepticon talk.
Tim, if you don't mind, mine's going to take much less time than yours, so I'm going to go ahead and start.
Do it up.
Okay, so, myself and my lovely wife, Trisha, went to Adepticon. It was a blast. Highly recommend anyone out there make the trek. The only criticism I have is it didn't seem like there was a lot of late-night privateer press activities, and I think that was an issue with not having a press gang. But what are you going to do? We signed up for the Masters Qualifier. Our intent was to only play the Masters Qualifier and then play some other game systems because that was our first time at Adepticon. So I brought Trolls, I brought Madrak and Borka 2 because I'm original. but I did have a different Madrak list. I had a Mountain King and Double Champs. I wanted to see how that fared. So round one, I faced Mr. Chad Kaufman. Is that his name right? Yeah, Circle Guy. So we had an interesting Borka 2, Una 2 matchup. I ended up winning the matchup, so that was great. I was feeling good. Round two, they post the list, the pairings, and I walk up, and there's a gentleman reading it, and I hear him say, Peter Soretti, and I look, and I was like, oh, that's me. He turns around, and he says, you're the guy who likes to jerk it on TV.
What?
I go, what? Yeah, I'm like, wow, well, hopefully you're one of the guys that likes to watch me jerk it on TV.
Right.
So
right.
We instantly clicked.
That was the win for you. That was the moment where you're like, I'm going to like this guy?
Absolutely, absolutely. So it was Jesse Carmack. He was playing Fianna 2, and I feel like I put Borka into it. I just don't remember because I got lost in his eyes.
Sorry. You don't remember what you put into the list? Continue, please.
Yeah. I told you I had a bad run. But sorry. No, it was a great game. He ended up winning. And then next round was this was probably the most interesting and painful game. Get matched up with a troll player. I'm 1-1. I'm still like, okay, I can, you know, there's three X and ones that are going to make it into day two. So I'm like, all right, let's get some work done. It's a troll player. I look at his lists. He has Madrak and Kolgrimma. And I look at him and I said, all right, we either need to make a gentleman's agreement in which we don't play Madrak and we play our off lists, or we hunker down and we play Madrak and we don't tell anyone about it. So we definitely picked the Madrax because he didn't want to play Kolgrimma into Borka 2 because that favors me, I believe, in the matchup because I had Linus and Adaria in there as well.
Adria.
No. Pete said it right. I'm on Pete's side. Pete said it again.
Adaria?
How are you on Pete's side? There's no extra. There's no E. It's E-D-R-E-A.
Yeah, you don't know how to spell Grant. Pete, say it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that the right way? I said it Adaria. Adria?
Yeah, Adaria. Linus and cool. Adaria.
Adaria.
Like, I dare you to say it wrong again, Pete.
So, yeah, we went Borka, I'm sorry, Madrak. This was a good learning lesson for me because I looked at his, I looked at the caster, Warlock is more technical, and I kind of briefly glanced over, and then we rolled dice. I should have taken the time to look at his list because Adepticon has some interesting terrain features. One, they had these privateer press, I guess, manufactured them. They were like little clear resin wispy things that they put on AoEs and said, those are clouds. And then they had these orange colored flame balls that they would put in a lake. They would put on a hill. They would put in forest. And that whole terrain piece was Burning Earth. So he had a, there was a big hill that was on fire, and I'm like, I don't want to mess with that. Come to find out, he had two units of Fire Eaters. So they were able to set themselves on fire by just tap dancing on the hill. It was amazing.
That's awful for you.
So I spent the whole game combat warding to keep my champs from getting set on fire. So the game came all the way down to last turn. He was able to use his bears to take out my objective, and then I needed to kill a impaler to actually go all the way to third tie breaks, and then I would have won on points destroyed. But I left that impaler on like three health boxes, and I just had to shake his hand on the game. It was interesting.
Did you know that, or is that what you figured out later? Like you weren't doing the math actively during the game to know that, right?
No, but it was one of those things where I could see what was left on my side of the table. I had a Mountain King, and I'm like, well, that's 30-some-odd points right there. I was thinking I had to have more. The other interesting thing that I learned, right around the five-minute mark that he had left on clock, I had a considerable amount of time, and I guess I engaged into, okay, I'm going to try to force clock at this point. Clocker scenario was what I was going for. And my opponent said he could tell. He said the light switch went on, and I went into delay mode and force him into clock, vice trying to force attrition. So I got to have a better poker face. And then the last round, I ended up playing Philip. I forget his last name, and I apologize because we went out to dinner twice. But hell of a guy. He had Heretic. I tried to put Borka and Mulg into him, and I couldn't seal the deal. So that was my run at Masters.
Nice, buddy.
Yeah. But then rest of the time, I got to play awesome game of Twilight Imperium, Battlestar Galactica, and then we played in the Bushido tournament. Like I said, I can't highly recommend the convention enough to people. It was an absolute blast.
You sure it wasn't Galactica?
No, it was yes, Galactica.
Okay. I wasn't sure. I don't know how we pronounce words on this cast anymore.
Why would you do that to him?
I don't know.
That's what we do now. That's our thing. We give platypus facts and make fun of people.
Oh my god.
So, on to you. How was your con?
Really good. Adepticon, this is the first time both Evan and I had been to Adepticon, so we were pretty excited about it. We posted a little bit on Arcane Assist about it, and we had a lot of fans of the channel come up to us and say, thanks for producing the content that you do, and we really like it, and please produce more X, whatever that is, usually the faction they played, sometimes the faction they wanted to play, like that kind of thing. And requests for more Convergence, more Retribution, more Circle, more Legion. I think almost every faction was requested at least once, which is cool.
That's awesome.
It means we're doing a diverse product, and we've got a lot of people who are excited about it. So it was really nice to have that kind of validation for the hard work that you put in. It's really cool when you see that. My Masters run was also not a universal success story. I played in the first round against Brett Fogel. Excellent gentleman, really, really great opponent. We had never actually played before, but I've judged a lot of his games over the years. He was playing minions, and he dropped Malok into me. I was playing Madrak 1 and Borka 2, which is the pairing that I played at the ATC, lists that I'm quite happy with, and I'm very, very deep into the number of games that I played with both those casters. We played a really, really tight game. There's some very important and pivotal components of that matchup, which is very, very positioning focused. I ended up seeding a couple of pieces that I shouldn't have at a kind of swing moment, but we both destroyed 80-plus points throughout the course of the game. It came down to the very, very relevant feature being the fact that he went second, and knowing that he was going to be able to score the final control point and we were going back and forth on points fairly quickly, I didn't have a swing turn that put me into a really commanding lead, so he managed to win on bottom of 7 on control point differential.
Wow.
Which is, like, it's a very, very close game, and I can't complain about that. It was my only loss on the day, and in a lot of ways the most noteworthy game that I played in the day. I also played Borka twice and Madrak one more time throughout the course of the day. They're both really good lists, and I've talked about them before. We can talk about them a bit more in detail, especially some specific components of it. The finished product was the Masters. I finished, I believe it was 14th overall. Funny story about that. there was somebody who posted, and I think the spirit of this post, and the original poster clarified about it, I think the spirit of this post was mostly positive, something to the tune of, like, if Tim Bahnke can't qualify for Adepticon Masters, then is the faction in a bad place or something like that. At least that's how some people interpreted it. He later clarified that, you know, it was just everybody has a bad day, and sometimes I have bad days, come last in a steamroller, like that kind of thing. And I think that's actually a really, like, that's a positive thought. It's a really good notion that, you know, everybody has bad days, even among, like, allegedly talented players. I think Brett and I were both a little disappointed to have been paired against each other round one. I was recovering from a long drive and just kind of feeling dehydrated and a little bit like, I hope I have an easy warm-up, and then neither of us got that easy warm-up. But the rest of my games were great, and I played against some really good opponents. Most of my success story was actually in Champions. Although, Pete, you also played in Champions, right? Did you talk about Champions?
No. So,
you played in the Bushido tournament. I'm
sorry. Yeah, we played Bushido tournament, right. Because, like I said, that was our first time at Adepticon. You don't get to play Bushido in the U.S., so that was our first time playing the tournament. It was a blast.
What is that?
Bushido is a skirmish game from GCT Studios. It's an English game. It very much has its roots in War Machine Mark II. Like you can feel that they took a lot of inspiration from that game. There's some. Jason Enos, if you're familiar with the name, he is a UK judge. He's the community manager for the game. So you have that kind of that influence of War Machine in there. But the models are just gorgeous. That's what drew me to the game. They're just beautiful sculpts, and it's a very cool game. Like, well, I'll have to definitely show you guys one day how to play it.
So do you guys want to talk about the con itself a little bit before we delve into the rest of... Because I've never been. I'm sure plenty of people listening haven't been. I don't know if you want to talk about the just the actual con.
For sure. So there's a couple of really neat features of Adepticon, and this was our first year. One of the things they do is they have a kind of tiered entry badge, which some conventions do. They have a VIG premium level badge and a standard entry badge. All of them come with some kind of a swag bag, largely supported by the incredibly large community of vendors that they have for the show. It's a 2,000 people plus convention, so they attract a fair number of vendors, and the kind of giveaways that you can expect. We got a copy of Kickoff from Steamforge, a two-player starter set for Dark Age, a bunch of limited minis, like a generous bag of cool goodies. I think the premium and the VIG, if you can get it before it sells out, packages are both well worth their value if you're a sort of eclectic gamer who's interested in a variety of things. The convention itself is a fully painted miniatures-focused convention. That's really neat. It's very, very exciting to play across the table from fully painted armies. And Travis made it clear at the beginning of all the events. Travis Mark, of course, judge extraordinaire. The only person who had more hours logged in the judge program than me, and a paid contractor with Privateer Press these days. He ran all of the privateer-focused tournaments and made it clear at the very beginning of them that the event was fully painted, and if your opponent's army was not fully painted, they would be disqualified. The rules for fully painted Adepticon are not the same as in the Steamroller packet. It's not Privateer Press standards of fully painted, it's Adepticon standards of fully painted, which is more in line with an old-school kind of Games Workshop concept of a three-color legal.
Sure, yeah.
Can't see bare metal, can't see bare plastic, and there's an expectation that the model have some colors on it. With that standard in place, almost universally the armies that I played against would be painted to what I would see as a reasonably high standard of painted. So it was very cool. Made the event incredibly photogenic, and there's a few sort of major features of Adepticon, including the armies on parade, where people who've come to the convention almost exclusively to show off their incredible armies are putting together like an entire Tyranid Hive world or an Adeptus Mechanicus Manufactorum, where they're building like Rhino Titans and giant Imperial Knights and just some really incredible things, lit up with LEDs or in the side of a mountain or just basically some of the more impressive creative hobby work you can sort of see in the industry. Beyond that, Adepticon has an incredibly large board game library, a huge vendor hall, and activities going on basically all night. The convention center that they're located in has an attached hotel. They fill that up and usually have to require a number of overflow hotels. We were in one of the overflow hotels, and we certainly had a great time. Being in Chicago, of course, the food's really good. We went for some Chicago deep dish pizza on one of the nights. And I would say overall it was a really cool experience. I've had it compared to, and being a seasoned Gen Con attendee, I think I agree with this, a sort of a Gen Con light experience or Gen Con without the crowds. Lots of people, lots of stuff going on, plenty of activities. But a good friend of mine and Chris, the gentleman who drove us down in our party, he said, in his experience with Gen Con, you almost always feel like there's something cooler going on that you could have been doing or should be doing, and that you kind of have this sort of urgency of like, why am I wasting my time doing this right now when I could be doing other thing?
Right.
And at Adepticon, there's a lot going on, and you feel like there's always something cool to be doing, but you get the experience of always feeling like you're in the right place.
That's a really interesting way to describe that. I've never been to either, but I like that description, just based on what I know about Gen Con.
Yeah, so, I don't know, pretty good show.
I would highly recommend, Grant, if you are changing up your con schedule for next year, mm-hmm. that you put Adepticon on the list. It was just an awesome show. Because, like, you know, if you're in between rounds, you can walk over to the next room over had Bolt Action, it had Batman, it had Team Yankee. It was just gorgeous stuff all over the place that you could just, you know, walk around and see everything. It was very cool.
In my personal convention rotation, I'm going to say Sue, War Machine Weekend, Lock and Load, Adepticon.
Nice. Well, Sue's not coming out of my rotation for sure, but so yeah, that sounds awesome. Do we want to get into the champions? I don't know, did we? Because we kind
of
talked about Masters a little bit, but
I can talk about my champions experience.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to do round by round, or, you know, however in depth you care to go, and then we can talk about your lists and go into depth about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So champions, I played Kolgrima and I played Borkatu. The Borkatu is the same list as I played in Masters, a list that I'm quite happy with. And then in pairing for that, I can't play Madrak in the champions format, so I played Kolgrima. And I played her in almost the same Madrak Band of Heroes list. Now, this is for a couple of reasons. One of them, model familiarity. I played a lot of Madrak, and I played a lot of Berka. And I feel like putting a pairing on the table that you know well, and you can kind of articulate the nuances of the list even when you start getting really tired, is really important. And by making just a caster swap, I can focus my attention on getting the most out of her toolkit rather than worrying about playing the list well. In turn, I think Band of Heroes in the current Champions format, and I'll provide that because the stuff they're testing in CID and bringing into the new development cycle for post-lock and load is going to change up the format quite a bit. But I think in the current Champions format, it's really important to have an answer in the form of RFP. Not just for Crix, although Dark Host alone demands a really compelling RFP tool, but for a lot of things in the Grimkin matchup, it's important to be able to RFP pieces like Kariana against Thagrosh 1, who's in the Champions packet. It's important to have access to RFP. Just a lot of things you really, really want to avoid tough, and you really want to be able to deny Collection of Souls. I'm going to kind of skim day one of Champions a little bit and talk in more detail about Champions Finals, which is the top eight that I qualified for on day two. In general, my day one experience was pretty positive. I played Kolgrima. It ended up being a bit of an interesting experience because we had 40 people registered for Champions and a good crowd. We ended up doing three rounds and then three rounds over the course of 2 days. And the DNC was over the course of both days. So I played Borka and Kolgrima, Kolgrima twice and Borka once. And then on the second day, I played Kolgrima twice and Borka once again. So a fairly even distribution of my casters. On the first day, Borka got to beat Signar, and he also got to beat... that was his list. And then Kolgrima got to beat Crix, and... she got to beat somebody else. I'm afraid I've forgotten.
That's okay.
Day two. My round one, we have kind of a funny experience. We get to the event, and I'm like, I've got a bit of a headache, and I'm feeling dehydrated. I get some water. I get some coffee. And I'm coming back from Starbucks, coffee in hand, a small croissant, and Mike Pierre comes up to me and he's like, hey, Tim, it's you and me. I'm like, oh, okay. We haven't played in 3 years since Lock and Load when we played Thagrosh 2 versus Durst and I lost on an embarrassing forgetting of a rule. So I'm like, well, Mike's a good player and he really knows his men off. It's a good format for him, but okay. And I'm like, what table are you playing on? He's like, table 2. I'm like, all right, well, my stuff's already at table 2, so I get over to table 2, and I start unpacking my stuff, and I'm like, do you have your lists? And he's like, oh, no, we haven't gotten them back yet. Like, oh, no problem, I'll go over to Travis and get them. And I'm like, Travis, Mike and I are playing, can I have our lists? And Travis is like, I haven't even done pairings. And I'm like, huh. And Mike's like, ah, how'd you go in there? Like, that's too bad, like, it's funny and whatnot. And I'm like, Mike, kind of a piece of shit. I mean, it's okay. I mean, Mike and I are buddies, and he's a good guy. I mean, we hung out in Belgium, and like, it's a blast. So Travis comes up, and he's doing pairings, and he's like, so this is kind of funny. You guys are paired against each other.
Nice.
So Mike and I end up playing
table two?
Anyway.
Wow.
Pardon me? No, it was on table 1. The table 2. So it was funny. He's like, I didn't make this happen. I didn't engineer it. Like, you guys are just playing. And I was like, all right, well, like, you know, there's a top 8. There's no easy matches left. Like, let's just do this. So we end up playing, and I drop Kulgrima, Band of Heroes, into, he's playing Durst. His Durst list has some really neat tools. And we kind of back and forth this conversation. And I know Mike is kind of into head games. He's got a bit of a, like, I'm clever, I'm Texan, and I've got like a, I've got kind of a little bit of one-upmanship occurring. And I don't actually mind that too much. It's fun in the right way. So he's kind of like, so what's Kulgrima's spell list? Oh, this thing. Oh, it can be tough. That can be good. And well, you're probably going to drop Borka anyway. And I'm like, ah. And then I'm like, yeah, I probably will drop Borka. And we kind of like, we danced that little game for a while. But I was pretty decided that I was going to drop Kulgrima into the matchup anyway. She's got some pretty cool tools. And I figured he would drop Durst. His pairing was Durst and Thyra. Now, Thyra's got some good things in terms of Silence of Death and some other pieces like that. But in general, she's got a giant army that relies on a bunch of tough no-knockdown Temple Flame Guard. And my entire list is no to tough. And then she's got a whole bunch of infantry, and I've got a whole bunch of 10-inch sprays. So, like, Thyra's not what's going to drop. So he's going to drop Durst, and I wanted either of my lists into Durst. But I felt like Kulgrima had good tools, and she sort of slam-dunked Thyra. So I was happy dropping her in case he played the kind of bait and switch. I knew what you were going to do and drop Thyra anyway. He makes the intelligent choice and drops Durst. His list has Zealots and a Sanctifier as kind of a module on their own with the UA. Durst has in his battle group Templar, Crusader, and he has the Avatar, Mechanic, Vassal to empower it, max unit of Dwarves, the Hammerforge. Hammer Dwarves. With an attendant priest, he has might be a max unit acquire, min unit acquire, something like that. And that might be it. Three jacks in the battle group. Yeah. Anyway, if I'm missing a specific piece. Oh, sorry, the book. Of course, he has the book. So there's some really important nuances to that matchup. One of them is that what I really want to do is Hunter's Mark something. And the attendant priest is going to say he can't target the dwarves with spells. The zealots are going to say he can't target us with spells. The avatar has spell ward, as does the book, and he's going to do no spells. All the jacks.
Yep.
So the only piece that I could conceivably Hunter's Mark is Durst, and that's not a compelling option because of the way he plays the positioning game. So he advances up the board, limits Kulgrima's tools as much as possible. I advance up the board, and I try to limit his tools as much as possible. She's weird when she gets to play as a support caster. She's used to walking up to the board and just sort of nuking things or engineering a compelling debuff of one kind or another onto a unit. If it's something she wants to hit hard, she delivers hard-hitting pieces with Hunter's Mark. If it's something that she needs to sort of whittle away at, she's got her pseudo-affliction, non-upkeep spell, Cursed Fate. If she just wants to go out and be a blaster caster, she has the best spray, the best two-cost spell in the entire game. I have no idea what that spell has any business doing on any caster at all, let alone one who has signs importance on her spellcasting. It's just ridiculous, and it's straight up won me multiple games throughout the course of the event. So, she... she blazes down clouds, because of course she also has Burning Ash as a cold spell. Just because reasons.
Just because, why not?
Yeah. So I fill up my stone, I get the opportunity to kind of dictate the tempo of the play. I put a bunch of clouds in front of champions, and I'm like, you can trample into these clouds, and you can do nothing because you'll be minus two to hit fighting champions. I give him a kind of, like, a choice. And now Mike thinks this is a mistake, and in hindsight, it may well have been. But I give him kind of a choice where he's got the Avatar threatening an entire zone because of Boundless Charge. And I say, here's a minion unit of champions with Tuffalo behind them to strike reprisal against anything that comes in on them. And then also just at the edge of threat range, here's an Earthborn, but to charge it, you have to land in a cloud. So that those are the kind of two options. Choose one, not both. That was on the left side of the board. Centrally, I've got my champions unpacking really aggressively up the middle. And then on the right-hand side, I posture my Fenblades, kind of threatening his Zealots, and he makes a mistake here. And I think Mike would probably agree that this was a mistake. He holds the Sanctifier back a little bit and gives me about half the Zealots, and is like, come in, kill these Zealots, fill my Sanctifier up with souls, and then I'll feed them back with mini feet. So I charge all of my Fenblades in on his Zealots, and I RFP them all. Because takedown is a theme benefit for the list, and as soon as the first one attacks, I'm like, RFP'd, no soul collection, and he's like,
fuck,
shit, yeah. That's a feat of this list. Yeah. And like, it's really interesting how sometimes like that can be the whole decider in a matchup.
Yep.
Like that just moment where you glitch on a theme force benefit for even a second, and it makes a big difference. So I felt pretty good about that, but there's a weird kind of amount of pressure his list can present, and at some point he's going to feed, and it's going to be a really big problem for me. The Avatar rolls up and gets 3 focus, and he empowers it to go to 4 focus, cast Boundless Charge on it. He feeds with Durst. He has a Jack, the Templar specifically, babysitting Durst. He sticks a whole bunch of the dwarves into the zone and has them all base-to-base with the Crusader, who also enters the zone. And he has the Sanctifier about an inch into control, move up in the zone that has the Fenblades. And he triggers Vengeance on the Fenblades and attacks them with some of the remaining Zealot models. The Avatar goes in on the Earthborn. So when the Avatar goes in on the Earthborn, it ends up in the cloud. And Mike and I, like I said, like, if you're going to place that model, let's start on a proxy base and see. And he's like, oh, it should be able to unambiguously go in here. And he was absolutely right. There was lots of room for it to be in the cloud. I was just like, I don't think there's a spot for it to land out of the cloud. He's like, oh, no problem. I don't care about being in the cloud. It just affects living, right? And I'm like, no, it does not just affect living anymore. Like, that's a Mark III change to Burning Ash. It's minus two to everything. And he's like, oh, shit. Okay, well, that's relevant. My Mat 8 avatar is now only Mat 6 because, again, every turn the choir is trying to protect the spells on his pieces so he doesn't battle the Avatar this turn. So he goes into the Earthborn, who's armor 20 because it's in the Stone Aura, but there are no obstructions on the entire... Sorry, yes?
Battle in Mark 3 now is only to damage.
It is. That's true.
Yeah, sorry. You're absolutely right, of course. Either way, Mat 8 goes down to Mat 6 because the Avatar's base mat. And... But when he goes into the Earthborn, he's dice minus 1. That's the important part. Because he's not battled... and I'm armor 20, but I don't have the benefit of an obstruction because there's literally no obstructions on the entire table. So he's got his charge attack, and he's like, do I boost the charge attack? Do I not boost the charge attack? Looking for the 6, and he opts to not boost the charge attack and misses the charge, which is a big deal.
Ruh-roh.
Yeah, it is. He's only at max reach range, doesn't get the shield in, so now he has 4 bot attacks because he's on 4 focus. Because of the free charge. So he buys 4 attacks at dice minus 1, and he leaves the Earthborn alive. Actually spikes a little bit on those attacks, so he leaves the Earthborn alive on 1 box, exactly 1 box, which is a bad place to be. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not an ideal set of circumstances at all. Comes back to my turn, and I confirm that the Avatar doesn't get the benefit of the armor from the feet because it's not a battle group model. I send the minion out of champions. One of them gets into the back arc of the Avatar. They do a bunch of damage to the Avatar. The Tuffalo behind them charge. They do a bunch of damage to the Avatar, and they hold kind of the very, very far portion of the zone on that side. Fenblades, Vengeance, they all position really aggressively to be able to make attacks and clear out a bunch of the remaining Zealots. And during this turn, they get the Zealots down to, like, one model left in their unit. And, oh, sorry, Mike's list also has Vilman in Faithful Masses. So I move Kilgrima up. She heals the Earthborn for 2. She casts Rage on it, and I position. She also casts Rage on the Mauler, and then she positions Defeat to push the Crusader out of base to base with all of the dwarves. So first she pushes all the dwarves. They're still base to base with the Crusader. They stay base to base with the Crusader. Then she pushes the Paladin behind the Crusader. Then she pushes the Crusader. Now none of the dwarves are base to base with the Crusader anymore, and she can kill them on Durst's feet turn. She pushes the Sanctifier, and my hope was I could get a vector, and we had like a judge come over and like try a bunch of different angles and see if it was even possible. My hope was to push the Sanctifier out of Durst's control area so that a combination of a charging Mauler and the Fenblades could kill the Sanctifier. I couldn't get it out of feet range, so that didn't happen. That's fine. Push the book out of the zone, and push a bunch of pieces back, including the attendant priest, leaving a bunch of dwarves out of formation. And then she vanishes back behind a centrally placed forest. So she feels super safe. She's got Owl's Wisdom up. She's hanging out, and a bunch of Mike's like plan for a defensive feat of kind of peeled apart. Champions move up. They kill the dwarves that weren't base to base with the Crusader anymore. Fenblades clear most of the remaining zealots. They put a little bit of damage in the Sanctifier, but it's really hard to damage it. Arm 23 and defense effective 12. The Mauler charges in on the Sanctifier, and I end up boosting a bunch of attacks here for sixes, looking to get like a headbutt knockdown and to do a reasonable amount of damage with the remaining bot attacks. Forcing to charge, boosting to hit the charge attack, boosting hit the second initial, and boosting hit the headbutt. Like, I end up not having very many actual attacks to make into it. Defense 12 is a bit of a puzzle for Maulers, and something that I like to fix with, you know, Cursed Fate, or any of the million spells that I would cast if I was able to cast spells on his models. Sanctifier survives, has taken a bunch of damage, but has nothing really important crippled. The Earthborn goes up to the Avatar, and four more dwarves in the zone. It kills all four dwarves and snacks them, and then finishes the Avatar with its last attack.
Nice.
So, Avatar's down. Most of the dwarf unit is done. He's got two dwarves and the Attendant Priest left. Vilman's alive and is angry. Crusader's alive and is angry. Templar's alive and is angry. And he's got the Sanctifier, who's also alive and angry. Sanctifier, so the course of the turn, the remaining elements of the Mike's turn, flips back to him, and he can't make ranged attacks, irrelevant. He's lost Pathfinder in some places. He can gain it with Boundless Charge. Functionally, my feat's over. Two dwarves kill the Earthborn. Templar goes in and kills the champions, the min unit of champions. Crusader goes in and it puts some damage into, but kills none of the larger Brick of Champions that includes Scaldi. Book comes back into the zone, and the Sanctifier attacks the Mauler with all of its attacks and leaves the Mauler on. One box.
Oh,
no. A little bit of spike in dice to actually get to the place where it leaves the Mauler on one box, but still felt good to have a second Warbeast survive on one box.
I hear Warbeasts on box work just as well as Warbeasts on full boxes.
It turns out they do, yes. It's a feature of Hordes. Hashtag value. He ignores the Fenblades almost entirely until he gets to one of the two remaining models in the Zealot unit, and they opt to attack a Fenblade. He toughs, but they've been damaged, so he triggers Vengeance again.
Fuck.
So, Vengeance Fenblades mostly position this turn to get charges on the Sanctifier. They make a couple of attacks on the Zealots and end up missing. This turn, they do finish clearing out the Zealots. Chronicler moves up, gives them charge of the Trolls. And they all charge the Sanctifier, and they kill it because it's engaged by the Mauler on one box. So they get plus 2 to hit and plus 2 to damage, taking them to power strength 14, and their charges kill the Sanctifier. The Mauler gets healed and gets rage cast by Kulgrima and walks in and kills the Crusader, which is now starting to collapse that side of the board. The Templar is doing work in the bottom zone, but the Tuffalo keep just slamming things. They slam the book out of the zone. They slam the Templar out of the zone. They do actually end up like having no solution to a vassal who's contesting that zone, but they keep just knocking things out and doing relevant damage and being defense 12, armor 18 with 8 boxes and tough, so they're just really obnoxious to deal with. The rest of the game unfolds over a couple of turns with me scoring the right-hand zone several times with the Fenblades, and eventually Kulgrima peels right back into that side. Durst makes some cool late-game plays where he charges in and he creates some clouds, kills a bunch of Fenblades, and does a whole bunch of work, but it eventually comes down to a point where Mike clears out the zone for everything but a Chronicler to deny me scoring in that zone with Durst and a Templar out of his control area left on the entire board, and I am at 4 points to 0, and I simply walk Kulgrima into the now uncontested zone and score to win.
Wow, that sounds like a really, really good game.
Yeah, it was. All this Co-Grimera talk has made me realize that I loaned you all of my 3-inch rings and I forgot to grab them from you.
Oh, really? For some reason, I thought they were Matt McWaters and I gave him 4 rings back.
Damn so it!
Oh, no, they're gone! They're in the ether of the War Machine community.
We'll return them to you in the suit. And if you listen to this episode of the podcast, Matt, bring those 3-inch rings for Pete or you're a piece of shit.
Yep. Bagged.
No, that's thanks again, Pete. I did appreciate that loan because the casting the cloud wall ended up being really pivotal in a number of matches. Next round, I played against Mike Mooney. Mike and I had actually played a match the previous day. We played in the qualifying events for Champions, and we played Kogrima into Thagrush 1. He's got Thagrush 1, Primal Terrors, double free Hellmouth, and a ton of War Spears. And I mean, like, it just feels like so many War Spears. His battle group is Typhon Double Rake, which is a really cool battle group for Thagrush 1. And then he just has Max War Spears with Chieftain, Max War Spears with Chieftain, Max War Spears, no Chieftain. Like, it's just, it feels like so many War Spears.
Oh, right, and that dynamic update went live, like, what, 2 days? Like, at Adepticon, right?
Yep.
Nice.
No. The dynamic update didn't go live.
Didn't they? Oh, no, it was just pre-releases. The pre-releases came out. So nothing... sorry.
We have to get our Legion information right. That's the one thing.
They did have a lot of Legion at this convention. Really, really gorgeous Hoth tables. Some very, very cool, like, Mustafar with a bunch of greats over top of it. I still think Jedi Mind Trick is overpowered, though. The War Spears have Vengeance in the Theme Force, which is a really big deal. And he did a really good job throughout the course of both the games that we played, sort of staggering the placement of his War Spears, giving me some of them from each unit, but then holding a number of them back so that he can get really relevant use out of Vengeance. The list is very good, and he also has Warmongers, Chieftain. Like, it's the full Ogre package, and it really feels like it. I think this list gets even better with the inclusion of things like Golob or Amok. So we'd played the previous day, and Mike's a guy from Louisiana, a really lovely accent, like super, super friendly player, and kept making like, you'll probably win this game, but I'll try to give you a run for your money type comments, while quietly being very good at the positioning game, like more than he let on. It was a fun game. Like, we had a really good time, but I was like, I don't buy any of your, like, oh, I'm not so sure if this is the right play or not. I'll just kill this thing over here. Like, he made a few comments like that, and I was like, nah, you're better at this game than you're letting on. We had a really good first game, and he actually put me in a really challenging position. He gave me, this is the day one, the qualifier event. I was his only loss that day, which is how he got into the top 8. He had a strong strength of schedule and won all of his other games pretty decisively. In that first game, he gave me an assassination on Thagrush, where I could put 2 Kogrima sprays onto him, and then taking a free strike from a rake and engineering a bunch of things that tied up my champions, I could get an Earthborn onto him, and then everything else in my list that was available was support. Thagrush was camping 3 and had excessive healing up. Here's the thing that's really weird about that. I don't know if you guys have ever done excessive healing assassination math, but if you don't transfer the first hit, every subsequent one that you do transfer, you get to heal back the damage that you took from the first hit. Because transfer damage still counts as having taken damage, so you excessive healing each and every time. So
did not know that.
Thagrush, who's a caster who has tough and has like -2 strength in his aura and his base defense 14 and armor 16, effectively 18 against melee attacks because of the minus strength aura, like, he's very, very, very hard to kill. And I'm like, if I get the crit with the spray, this is a worthy assassination. And I'm looking at the board, and I'm like, I don't actually have a lot of other outs here. Like, he positioned Thagrush really aggressively, but, like, attrition is kind of starting to swing his way. So I spray him twice, and I boost hit both times, and I fail to crit both times. And I boost damage once, and I think the only reason he lost this game is because he transferred the first hit. If he didn't transfer the first damage roll, he would have gotten another D3 heal, which is a really big deal. I end up charging the Earthborn in. He does damage to the rake, spikes the damage roll, but does it to an even numbered column so nothing gets taken out on the Earthborn. Earthborn boosts at its charge attack, hits the 8, does a good chunk of damage, which gets transferred. Boosts at its second initial, hits the 8. At this point, has charged, has boosted to hit. I debate whether or not I boost damage. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a transfer either way. So I roll the damage, and then I buy an attack and try to roll a hard 8. I hit with that hard 8, and he transfers to Thagrush, who at this point dies because both of his rakes are full. I didn't realize quite how damaged Thagrush, or pardon me, Typhon had been, because Typhon had taken a couple of sprays earlier in the game. Again, Colgrim is spray, super overpowered, does everything, signs importance as a busted spell, etc., etc., things you've heard all before. Does a bunch of damage to Typhon, backlashes a couple of points to Thagrush, and now he's spent his transfers, but the Earthborn is totally full. And I've got basically nothing left, and Thagrush is on like 9 boxes, like just a kind of embarrassingly high amount. So the only thing I've got left is the Fel'Collar hero, and they're called heroes for a reason. The Fel'Collar hero gets Charge of the Trolls from the Chronicler, which is +2 to hit and damage against models that are in the melee range of one of your Warbeasts.
Oh, shit.
The Earthborn's right next to Thagrush, and he's scoring my flag. And then the Fel'Collar hero Fel'Calls himself,
yep,
and charges Thagrush, goes to mat 10, and is a power strength 11 because of the Stone Aura, Weapon Master. So he hits Thagrush and then does a truckload of damage. And Mike's like, oh, a tough check. And I'm like, no, he's a warrior model. He denies you're tough.
Oh, my God.
So that was the first game we played, which was suitably epic, and we were both like really excited at the end of it. So we get matched up again in this game, and he's like, oh, Kilgrim again, let's see how this goes. And I'm like, well, now he knows my tricks.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I got no outs now, right? So we end up playing what turns into a really, really cagey rotational positional match in Breakdown. So we're again looking at a situation where he's pressuring really, really hard with War Spears on one side, and I send my Fen Blades in. He has an opening play. I've given him like a whole bunch of Fen Blades, all blocked up, well outside of your threat range, including assault throws. Here's one Fen Blade in range to be dragged by a Hellmouth.
Yep.
And he's like, that's a trap. And I'm like, yes, it is.
Sure is.
So he runs a Spell Martyr up, and he shoots an Obliteration past it into the packed up Fen Blades. And I'm like, okay, a Blitz AoE 5. Like, he has to drift to get this, but like, if he lands that in a chunk of Fen Blades, this is actually kind of a fuck up on my part. The Obliteration drifts back and kills the bait Fen Blade. And he's like, well, that couldn't have gone worse. So I'm like, that couldn't have gone better from my perspective.
You took the bait without even knowing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a good line of play. It's just sometimes dice hate you.
Yeah, sure.
They kind of shift left and manage to like get deep charges going around his jamming Hellmouth tentacles. And they charge in. Charges are weird. I didn't have the opportunity to Fel'Call them because the Fel'Caller was right on the board, like very, very far to the right, giving up Pathfinder to the champions to come up the forest. And the champions had been like, you know, clouds in front of them to protect them from Hellmouth tentacle charges so they didn't get dragged out. And like, they're trying to like make forward progression while respecting his threat ranges. So on that side of the board, they end up being mat 6 into defense 14 against the charge. So like, I'm looking for spikes and I get a couple and I kill a couple of the war spears that have prayed them. But rapidly, the kind of relative quality of his elite troops starts to eclipse the Fen Blades, and he's making forward progression on that side after a couple of turns. On the right side, however, I'm making great progression because champions plus Colgrimus sprays plus the Long Riders who are there are great at just piling into a whole bunch of War Spears. And they do with authority. The Earthborn's positioned on that side and is kind of body blocking for the champions with Earth's Blessing up so it can't get pulled by the Hellmouth tentacles. And Colgrima has a turn where she just comes up real aggressively, sits on her flag, and feats on almost his entire army. Catches Typhon, which is critical, catches Thagrush, catches most of the War Spears, and says, there you go. And he's like, oh, you're on 0, and he came up and he did a whole bunch of sprays to kill all the warmongers and to kill like a whole bunch of the War Spears and to just kill all my jamming stuff. I think I can kill you with Typhon sprays. And I'm like, nope, can't make ranged attacks. And he's like, oh, that's a really good feat. And Jake at this point has just wrapped his game and he's walking by and he's like, Kogrima, well, she's bullshit. Kills my faction identity. That's super classy. And I'm like, yeah, like, she's good against Legion. So he kind of has a little bit of a bad turn there because he ends up making a bunch of melee attacks against champions while losing half the damage expectation of those War Spears from their assault throws. So he ends up going into champions and getting kind of a poor alpha that doesn't kill enough of them. And then the zone on his side is collapsing, but he starts scoring it a turn later than I do. And he gets 1 point of the zone when I've quite thoroughly removed everything from the right-hand zone, and I'm scoring to 3 points at this point, getting both my flag and the zone. And then I take my entire stone unit, and I'm like, I don't need this to protect the pieces where your army is no longer present. So I just run my entire zone into my entire stone into his zone. So they're not, like, they're armor buffing themselves and a chronicler, but there's an entire stone unit that he has to deal with. and they're just spaced out nicely, so his war spears can't get really profitable assaults. And there's one Fenblade drummer left that is kind of inconveniently placed so that he can't cycle prey very well, and it takes him just like a turn longer than it should to kill them. So he has to send Typhon over to contest the flag, so I'm not scoring 2 to his 1 or 2 to his 0 if he can't clear out the stone. And then he ends up putting Typhon in a little bit of a sacrificial spot to come in and do a bunch of work on the Mauler. Finishes the Mauler, and he's got Typhon really far up. I body block with the Tuffalo, the circular zone on the right-hand side, and instead of turning the Earthborn around and trying to kill Typhon, which I decide isn't likely to happen because he needs 7s to hit, he just dice off 5, and he has rapid healing up, I just move the Earthborn forward, and I kill the Hellmouth and the remaining Warspear. So the only thing he can get into my zone is Typhon. So he has to get Typhon into the zone to stay in the game. He charges Typhon at an angle to get past one of the Tuffalo that he's charging, and that's really good for me because at this point there's no spray assassination on Kokorima. Like, he's safe not killing me. Kills the Tuffalo, gets in the zone, but the remaining Tuffalo is able to slam him out of the zone, and that's the game. That takes me to a scenario win in that round. Like, there are no easy wins in the top 8 of an event like Champions, but we played a really, really tight game, and I managed to get another scenario win with Kogurima, who's super great. At this point, that headache I mentioned from round 1 is hitting me really hard. I'm super dehydrated, really exhausted. It's just been a long weekend that I haven't been kind of doing a good job of attending to my own health. So I take some Advil, and I jump into the last game, and it's against Matt McWaters, who came in the car with us. And I'm like, Kogurima's challenging and fussy, and she's a lot of work. The last scenario is recon. I'm just going to drop Borka. I know him a lot better. The list is really good. He's going to drop Denny 2 Black Industries, and Borka's a brick breaker, and I've got the no incorporeal stone. So I'm happy in this matchup. Let's do it. I'm going to brush over this one pretty quickly. Lots of things happened, but again, I had a pretty bad headache for parts of it.
Well, you were dehydrated and then drank a bunch of coffee, so like that super.
Well,
helps.
I did. I also drank a really, really nice Belgian red that Andy had brought. It's actually from Wisconsin, but it's like my favorite kind of beer, which is the Belgian red. We had the Delirium Red while we were in Belgium, and it was just absolutely amazing. And he brought this. It's like a Wisconsin special, and it's Polaris, I think, is the name of the anyway, not spectacularly important, but it was just absolutely delicious. But it was like 10 in the morning, which is not normally when I start drinking either.
Right.
I'd had some water, but the convention, they had like bottled water at the convention was $4.50.
Fuck.
Yeah. I bought 2, and Trish was ready to fight them behind the counter. She was like $9 for 2 bottles of water.
And I assume they didn't just have water out at all.
They did.
But it went, like, it emptied really quickly throughout the day, and they refilled it once in the morning. Like, that was it. So it just, like, and it they were spaced pretty wide out, and they emptied pretty quickly, so and that was just how it was. So we ended up all being dehydrated because we didn't want to pay these exorbitant prices. And the crazy thing was, like, their food prices weren't crazy. Like, I don't know, it was, like, $6 for, like, a personal pizza and $4.50
for the water.
I don't know. It was just wild. Anyway, not spectacularly important, but anyway, I've got a bit of a headache, and I'm trying to play this match. And there's some things that are really great for Borka on Recon. You can put whelps on flags to score. You've got 10 whelps, so you can use them to contest if you just kind of bleed them gradually throughout the course of the game. So there's a bunch of really cool tools in the matchup. I'm going to go through maybe the 5 moments during the course of this game that caused me to collectively lose the game. The sort of beats of the matchup. I unpack my list fairly well, and I leave Rock on a flank. Rock has Stumbling Drunk, but he's near the periphery of my control area. The expectation is I'm going to control Stumbling Drunk when it's unprofitable to me by whelp placement. He casts a Hellmouth at a whelp to pull Rock to the edge of my control and to pull Adrea in and kill her. I've moved Adrea up to get damage in on an arc node, I want to say. Mostly because I've held Linus back and I'm bleeding Adrea because I have to trade something in the piece trade, and she's not very important in Recon, especially against his list that doesn't have a lot of pieces that she needs to kill. She's not great at killing Warwitch Sirens, and there's nothing else in his list that she's super excellent at killing. And Overlords win the fight versus her, so she's not on the same side of the board as his Overlords. He pulls Rock a little bit in, and I'm like, okay, this is the part where he rolls 7 to damage Rock, and I get to put a whelp down, and I don't have to stumble unprofitably. He rolls exactly a 6 for damage, does 0 damage to Rock, who's outside of the stone, which means I'm hit, so I have to trigger stumbling drunk, but I'm not damaged, so I can't elect to place a whelp before I do. I stumble exactly 3 inches, basically, toward him in the most profitable way possible, which takes me out of Borka's control area, means I don't get to stumbling drunk anymore, and also puts me in threat range of his slayers. He sends his slayers in, and collectively his slayers finish Rock. He's actually probably the most disposable heavy in the actual matchup, but it's still awkward to lose the Primal Animus that early in the game. In retaliation, I send an Earthborn in on his slayers, and I send an Axer and a Storm Troll up. They do a lot of work against the slayers. They end up killing one and doing a bunch of damage to the other two. On the right-hand side of the board, he sent an Overlord in to contest my flag. The Overlord gets killed by Mulg, who moves up to do so. And I've got an Earthborn really, really far forward within range of both water and an obstruction that he just wants to ignore. So he kind of pulls back, trying to play conservatively around my threat ranges. And I feat... So he opts to, instead of attacking pieces and becoming stationary, he opts to throw one Earthborn that's threatening Denegra into the zone. That Earthborn's pretty high on Fury, and again, the throw rolls a 6 to do no damage to the Earthborn, which doesn't allow me to spawn a whelp to remove all of its Fury, which is also a little bit awkward. He then contests with a second Overlord, and that's the only thing contesting the right zone on Recon. At this point in the game, I have already scored 2 points, one on my flag and one on the zone, and he has scored no points on his side of the board. He's cleared enough pieces this turn to bring the score to 1 for him and 2 for me. So my plan this turn is I'm going to let Mulg Frenzy. He'll roll a boosted 7 to hit the Overlord. Assuming he rolls the boosted 7, the Overlord dies. I score 2 points in my flag and zone. I move Linus in to contest his flag, and we go to 3-1, and then I just have to score... again, to win the game, because he doesn't have pieces that can get into contesting range of my flag at that point. Mulk misses the boosted 7 on the Frenzy. Orca moves over, boosts to hit a Frost Hammer, misses the boosted 9.
Oh!
Which hurts real bad. Like, at this point, I'm starting to tilt on my dice, which is, like, again, bad dice happen, and you just have to be emotionally prepared for them. Because of the state I was in feeling emotionally, I was just, like, responding to that in a really negative way, which is unhealthy habits as a player. So I'm like, well, Gambler's Fallacy has my back.
Yeah,
I'll just go again. Like, I'm just going to keep rolling dice, and eventually they'll come up right. Not, by the way, how math or logic or anything intelligent works when you're not feeling tired. So I'm like, well, we'll just see if he can roll a hard 9 with the last 2 of his Fury. And I just, like, do that, and obviously that one misses too. So I pull the Earthborn back, which is what the plan should have been before Borka spent the last 2 of his Fury. Instead of throwing a Slayer out of contesting range of the zone, I simply walk the Earthborn over and kill the Overlord. That allows me to get to 3-1 instead of 4-1, which means instead of decisively winning the game, I've kind of bought him some time. But more importantly, I've left Borka exposed.
Yeah.
And the turn before that, he'd spent all of his attention with Deathjack, Denegra, and the Warwitch Siren spraying down my stone. So he's killed the stone. This means he now has a feat, and Borka is in range. If he runs the Arc Node, Damnation's Borka, and also Breath Steals him, to charge Deathjack onto Borka. None of this should have happened. There's no reason Borka couldn't have just repoed back, been out of range, been in Arcane Vortex range of Mulg, had
yeah,
2 more transfers.
Yeah.
There's like a million things I could have done in that situation, and all of them are mistakes. Matt, my opponent, did an excellent job of capitalizing on them, saw the opportunity and seized it, knew that that was his out for the game, took it, and Deathjack killed Borka without too much effort. Tenegra's got some really excellent vectors of assassination, and I think learning to play around all of them is going to be the difference between people who feel quite confident in Denegra 2 and people who feel like she's an impossibly broken caster.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to know them, you have to understand them, and you have to respect them. It was a great game. Matt was gentlemanly the whole time. I think it's actually the first game we played, despite both being Canadian players. I think the matchup is quite winnable. In fact, he spent most of the game saying how aggressively favored I was in the matchup, which is another instance of those times where I'm like, Borka 2 just really does have way more depth and way more game than I give him credit for every time. I keep talking about him like he's a Signar answer, and that list is just diverse and powerful and really good in a lot of places. And even on a turn where he was like, you're just going to frenzy everywhere, I still got the meaningful attack I expected to get out of Mulg, which under most circumstances does exactly the job Mulg is supposed to do, which is kill the single Overlord. Get to take the Fury that I needed off the Earthborn, get to take the Fury that I needed off the Storm Troll, pass multiple threshold tests because I just need to roll sevens, and if I've got four instances of rolling a seven or less, I'm going to get one or two of them quite confidently. And in situations where he rolls sevens for damage, I can spawn whelps and control my Fury work. It was a good game, and he's a very, very good player. And I felt... with a little bit of luck, I was capable of pulling that one out. It was a great run at Champions, and overall I got second, which felt nice. It's not a final table variant event, but I did manage to have really good strength of schedule, really good CPs, and that carried me to a win.
Yeah, that's awesome. Sorry, I meant to intervene sooner. Not intervene, but like talk more, but I felt like I was like listening to the podcast. Like I was just like listening to you talk about your game. So.
All right, Grant.
That's awesome. That was a great description of the games. That gave me a really good feel of what went down. So I know there was a little bit of a request to talk about the lists themselves that you're playing and why the Kolgrim of Borka 2 pairing. So I don't know. Do you want to get into a little bit of that? I mean, we've got three of you fucks on here that play trolls. So we want to talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, specifically the Masters pairing, or
sure. What you've kind of been. You've been playing that a lot.
I think more so than anything, because you've hinted at it a lot, Tim. Is what is the overwhelming strength that the Borka 2 list brings?
Sure. Yeah. We'll start.
That's a really good question. So I guess first things first, for anyone who hasn't seen it before, I'm going to go over what the list actually is. So it's Borka, Vengeance of the Rhymeshaws. This is Borka 2, the one who's on a bear. He got a significant rework in CID, so it's worth having a glance at his card. I'll go over most of his abilities and some of the really unpredictable nuances about them. His style of play, more than anything else, is a real control caster. I call him a brick breaker a lot because he plays into bricks really, really well and has a lot of tools that cause them to tear apart. But he has an unusual kit. He's quite difficult to assassinate. Gets to play a very forward presence on the table, and despite only having three spells on his card, gets an enormous amount of work out of them. Rest of the list is a Rune Bearer, which is basically the secret to why trolls are seeing a significant resurgence with its new Arcane Repeater ability. It also has Harmonious Exaltation, which, if no one's used it yet, is an excellent podcast name. And he has Spellslave, which is important because he's a Magic Ability 6 Spellslave, so he's actually better at casting Frosthammer than Borka is under a lot of circumstances. The battle group consists of two Earthborn Dire Trolls, Mulg, Rock, who is Borka's character beast, so is allowed in the power of Dunia Theme Force, a Storm Troll, and an Axer, a Troll Axer. Furthermore, the list has two modules of Whelps, who alongside the Rune Bearer are the free choices for the number of battle group points that you brought. It is a minimum stone with a Stone Scribe Elder. The minimum stone is a major concession. If I could change anything about the list, it would be this. I think Max Stone is almost always the right choice in troll lists. I think it's a huge concession to drop down to Min Stone. There are a number of games where the matchup would be fundamentally different if I was playing Max Stone. The way I could position on the board would be different. And the fact that I have to play Min Stone is the reason I don't have... either the Whipping Winds oriented stone, it's one of the reasons, and also the other reason that I don't have something like Janissa in the list instead of having the second module of Whelps, because the Whelps are important for spreading really wide, and you can't do that with your battle group and list alone unless you have a max stone. I also have Linus and Adrea, who are, I would argue, something of a saucy include. The list was originally conceived while I was staying over at Pete's place and recorded a game for Not Snakes. During that game, Linus and Adrea performed admirably, and post Blindwater CID, they got significant improvements that make them really worth including in this list. Adrea is pivotal in the Gravediggers matchup, where she can remove clouds. She's very, very good in the Grimkin matchup, where she can kill Gremlin Swarms. She's anti-stealth tech, she's reach for the list, and more importantly than anything else, she allows you to deploy your entire army on the left side of a scenario that has multiple circles, and deploy just them on the right-hand side, and either require that your opponent commit significant resources in terms of power level to kill your 5-point unit to begin scoring that side, or threaten to score a circular zone with a unit that's difficult to dislodge. Late game possibilities, Linus also has a reach melee weapon that a lot of people forget about. He wields a greatsword. Linus routinely underperforms. He's just kind of terrible. Fluff diversion, and I apologize for it. Linus and Adrea are teaching assistants. If anyone doesn't know this particular component of the narrative, like, Victor Pendrick is basically the Indiana Jones of the War Machine setting.
This is Banky
professor
lore.
By day, and like goes off into the wilds and fights monsters and just kind of messes them up, and then comes back with like monster heads and ancient relics that he's stolen from other cultures or whatever, and is like, oh, I'm gonna tell everybody in my class about this. He teaches at the Signarian University, which is why he's partisan Signar, but also a Minion model, and he's like out there killing things in the wild. Linus and Adrea are his TAs, and I think they're pretty awesome. They're grad students. Adrea, and I'm going to continue to pronounce her name like that. Sorry, Pete.
That's correct.
No worries.
Adrea
is like, she's a naturally magic spellcaster who's like worked hard to make her way in like the human stratified system that's like, I don't want to call the Iron Kingdoms out a little bit, maybe a little unfeminist in the way that they've like oriented things. They've got this like boys club of adventurers, and she's like, I'm a very talented wizard, and I'm also a very talented academic, and I've like worked really hard to get here, and here I am putting my best foot forward. And Linus is like the shitheel guy who got in on the fact that like his dad was part of the university, and like, you know, he's an alumni, and he's kind of a frat boy, and he's just sort of there. And he just has really no redeeming abilities other than the fact to, like, bandage up a dire troll's toe. Like, just an absolutely garbage inclusion in this otherwise, like, powerful, hardworking female character that's, like, trying to make a name for herself in her academic pursuits while, like, doing necessary field work. And he's like, I brought a book! And, like, and a greatsword I don't know how to use. So usually a lot of attention is put to killing Adrea, and late game Linus is like, I'm still here, I can score a zone. I charged you with a greatsword and missed with my mat of five.
Mat five, womp womp.
Or maybe he aimed with his range 10 military rifle and missed you with a rat of now 7 with an aiming bonus.
I don't know, applied knowledge, you know, it's pretty good sometimes.
Yeah, he can tie a band-aid on a dire troll's toe.
Yeah.
Like, that's his job. That's what he actually does. He goes over and first aids someone. And then, like, once in a blue moon, he lets Borka scalpel out a system. But, like, it happens very rarely because often they deploy on the opposite side of the board. Anyway, Adrea, like, worth 5 points. Yeah. Linus, worth -1.
Like, like, the unit should cost 4 points just because of Linus. Yeah. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, that's Linus exactly right. Top billing.
That's awesome.
You have, in your Borka list, you have two pods of whelps.
Yep.
Yeah.
How many do you start the game with on the board? And then how do you use them mid-game?
Okay, so this is a shitty answer, but it's matchup dependent.
Okay.
Usually I deploy a number, and it's less than 5 almost all the time. Depending on first turn or second turn and matchup, I usually have to cast Rush with the Axer on the first turn, which means the Axer either wants to charge to get position if he's not playing against guns and he wants to be able to do things in the mix, or he wants to walk after spending 2 fury. In most of those situations, that means that he can have a whelp hang out with him. So that's one whelp you have to deploy for fury management on turn 2. That's fine. You can afford to bleed some whelps. I also deploy usually 2 whelps, one on either side, so that they can go contest the zones. So in the turn where they're like, you have to stick something in to contest the zones, I'm like, how about whelps? And they're like, well, that's a terrible thing to peace trade with. And I'm like, yeah, it sure is. You can come charge this whelp and I'll kill you. That's good. Like, that's really good. And like, a lot of people are like, well, if you just stick whelps into the zone, like, don't they just shoot them with something? And you're like, yes, but under Snow Shroud, they can be defense 14, so they're non-trivial to shoot. Sometimes they can use terrain to protect themselves. And in a situation where they come in to, like, kill the whelp with something in melee, you can countercharge with a beast, even if you, like, position yourself relative to terrain or relative to other models to, like, fail the charge by bumping something. You can usually have that beast also contest the zone. So you can kind of wait to see what they put into positions to threaten your pieces before you expose them. So, like, the whelps are really key to kind of playing the yin and yang of that scenario. That's the most conservative deployment, is three whelps. Sometimes I'll deploy four in situations where I feel like Linus and Adrea on their own can comfortably contest a zone. Sometimes I'll deploy just the one for the Axer and just the one for the other zone, the one that Borka is going to be in. If the matchup wants me to just, like, stack Mulg full of focus so that Arcane Vortex can protect Borka from, like, a really credible early assassination or prevent debuffs being placed on beasts, or if I'm just, like, he's playing Haley and he's just going to try to TK all of my shit around, I just Mulg Riles for three and runs and stay central to protect those pieces, and then, like, Earth's Blessing Earthborns kind of, like, lock him into place so he's hard to dislodge with some of those tools, and a whelp babysits him so that I can remove all of his fury on the subsequent turn. In the matchups where I don't need to run the Storm Troll on the first turn because the kind of targets that it wants aren't readily available and it can just walk on the first turn, in those matchups, Adrea can actually cast Wind Blast at Mulg, and he Arcane Vortexes it so that he can run for free, air quotes. And in those matchups, you don't even have to deploy the Whelp for the Axer. So you can deploy one for the zone if Linus and Adrea can reasonably contest theirs, or one for each zone, or even no Whelps in those matchups. The ways that I use Whelps, one of the most important ways to use Whelps is somebody charges a Warbeast, and you want to place a whelp in the spot where the follow-up heavy has to charge, because often they need to use two heavies to kill an Earthborn who's next to an obstruction and in a stone aura, or sometimes they need to use two heavies to kill something like Mulg. You also use whelps to control Rock's placement. So Rock has two conditional trigger effects. One of them is when he's hit, he stumbles if he's in Borka's control area. Can't be knocked down, and he moves according to a deviation template, D3 inches in a direction, and then you get to choose his facing. So that's really powerful because traditional circumstances, they charge him with a turtle, they hit Rock, and he walks away, and now he's out of threat range. And they're like, I just lost that peace trade, which is, again, why I describe Borka as a brick breaker, because he's got a lot of things that can force you to lose a peace trade. Sometimes Stumbling Drunk is a double-edged sword. It can cause you to have Rock stumble into threat range or out of control area or in awkward spots. In those sort of situations, using whelps to control the orientation of his Stumbling Drunk is really powerful. So both effects say after the attack is resolved, one of them triggers on hit, one of them triggers on damage, both of them have the same timing interval for resolution. So you get to choose whether you place the whelp first or you stumble first. Hmm. That means that you can be like, well, I definitely don't want to stumble to the five. I'll place a whelp right there so the Mulg doesn't stumble in that direction. Also, you can do pseudo-Grimkin things, like placement of Gremlin Swarms with Annoyance to increase the defense of Skin and Bones. Your defense 12 heavies can be kind of defense 13 after the first attack, because you place a whelp in range of a living enemy model, make it harder for them to do things. So whelps are about blocking charge lanes, they're about controlling placement of Stumbling Drunk, they're about getting defense value, they're about positioning for scenario play, and my favorite one is when someone charges the Storm Troll, who has repulsion, they get their heavy pushed back an inch, and then you spawn a whelp in the only other place where they can charge the Storm Troll. And you're like, not only did your heavy not kill my light, but your second heavy can't. Mm. Which feels really good. Occasionally I've used whelps as firing beacons for e-leaps.
Sure.
Which is also pretty good. Yep. And then in situations that have flags, they're the most disposable flag scoring pieces imaginable. A whelp is a solo. It scores a flag, contests its own. I mean, you have 10 additional models. It's like having an entire unit that can be in all the places on the board at once. So they're theoretically the tar pit of the list, but they usually, I like to have six available to me, and I'll spawn them pretty aggressively when the situation calls for it. You don't want to just give them away, because they are actually pretty valuable, but you do want to be able to spawn them in spots where people are like, well, I didn't plan for that.
Yeah, I've gotten got on that a bunch of times, where all of a sudden I'm like, clearing a zone and all of a sudden there's a whelp and I'm like, well, shit, I don't have an attack for that, and I can't score the zone now.
Yeah, a core component to the list is mental density, like just the number of out-of-activation effects that I have in this list. So obviously it's a countercharge skew. Borka has battle charged, which means all of his models in his battle group get countercharge. And people are like, yeah, these beasts have countercharge. And they're like, wait, the Axer also has countercharge? Like, yep, it's a beast in his battle group. And they're like, oh, I didn't expect the Storm Troll to countercharge there. I kind of was thinking about it more like a gun. Well, that's a problem because that now kills an infantry model, and now I don't have enough to kill the beast anymore. Or the best one is actually when Borka countercharges. Pro tip, few facts about Borka's countercharge. He gets to make an impact attack if you move 3 inches. His impact attack has auto knockdown and trash, so you get a POW 14 weapon master attack.
Ugh.
Also, his melee attack has crit smite. So there are situations where Borka will charge in, knock you down, smack you out of the way, or like 2 inches back just to block a charge lane for something else. And you're like, what? That's not okay. Like, or if Mulg gets to countercharge something, and they're like, well, now I've got Mulg here. Like, Mulg is now 6 inches closer or 7 inches closer to where I don't want Mulg to be. And Mulg is Primal Rage, so when they make an attack against Mulg, he gets to walk 4 inches toward them and hit something.
Yep.
And that's, like, when I say something, I don't mean, like, the model that damaged him. Sometimes it's just something else. So, like, you have a situation where someone's like, well, I got two heavies here. This one's going to come up, and it's going to hit Mulg. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to walk a little bit closer to the model that just hit me, and I'm going to whack the other heavy. And they're like, oh, like, Mulg could quite reasonably take out a system there. Like, now my math on what kills things has changed. So the list is just about, it's about that mental density. Like, so many of the things in my army interact on your turn. It's inevitable you're going to forget something. Hmm. And that's very, very taxing to play against. So I think it's one of the key features of the list. It's why, like, I played against an EMO3 player, and halfway through the game, he was like, well, force Hammer Mulg to get him out of the way. And I was like, Arcane Vortex. And, like, that's a 4-cost spell that's not cast now. And, you know, 5 or 6 turns later in the game, the same thing happened. He was like, oh, Arcane Vortex Mulg. And I'm like, or I'll force Hammer Mulg. And I'm like, Arcane Vortex again. And you just, you can't be reasonably expected to keep track of all of those elements of an opponent's list in the sort of dynamic moving flow of a tight game. So it significantly advantages the Borka player when a game is quite tight, when there's just so many, I hesitate to say gotcha moments. And I'm pretty permissive if anyone has played against me. Like, I'll say, like, watch out for this, watch out for this, watch out for this. But, you know, having given that explanation and having clarified sufficiently, like, that's where you're moving. Are you sure that's your final placement? Are you happy there? My opponent will say, yep, confirmed, definitely there. That's where I'm going. I'm making this charge attack. I'm like, okay, flip it to my clock. I'm going to countercharge. Yeah. And just playing like that, there's only so much you can do. You either make the conscious choice to remember everything on Borka's card, to religiously read all the things, to be preternaturally aware of all of the things that are happening, and you run out of time. Or you sacrifice some expectation of how the game is going to turn out to being able to play quickly, and the Borka player is advantaged by being able to position more aggressively.
The other nice thing with Mulg is people will forget that when you target your, or when you cast a self spell, that you're actually targeting a model and you're within 3, he can Arcane Vortex it off. Yep. That's a really good got you, but not a got you. Like, it's just, you're just playing in the rules. So
my favorite moment was actually when Butcher 3 pulled in Rock and Earthborn and Mulg, and I'm like, you want to pull in this, he moves into position, he goes to pull them all in. I'm like, okay, great. You pull in Rock, you pull in Mulg, you don't get the Earthborn because he's Earth Blessinged. And he's like, oh shit, of course, it's a push effect. Okay, fair enough. Well, I got 2 heavies, no problem. Flashing Blade. I'm like, Arcane Vortex with Mulg.
Nope.
And he's like, okay, buying a he buys an attack on Mulg, and he buys an attack on Mulg, and Mulg hits him, and he has enough damage that he has to spend a focus to reduce it because he's like afraid of like getting really into threat range, and he's like, well, that's really bad. So he's spent 2 to pull them in, and he's spent 1 to Flashing Blade, and then he spent 1 to attack Mulg and 1 to reduce focus. So he buys another attack on Mulg, he feats, he gets 5 more, okay, or sorry, 6 more. He buys an attack on Mulg, he buys an attack on Mulg, he buys an attack on Mulg and kills him. He buys an attack on Rock. Rock stumbles away, pops a whelp to heal the damage. And he's on 2 camp, and he's like, I think I just die here.
And I'm like, primal Rock? Yeah, you just die there.
You do. You do die there. And also an element of the list that is maybe one of my favorite things that you don't get to see very much on the tabletop is Primald Mulg. So Primald Mulg kills a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. Mm-hmm.
I played him into Morgul 2, and Morgul 2 had the Swarm Animus up on himself, so he was defense 18 and steady. And I was like, okay, boosting to hit, looking for a 9. And my opponent is, oh, did you forget Swarm? And I was like, I did not.
Sure didn't.
Just mat 9, power strength 22.
God.
Including plus 1 strength from the stone, of course.
And I also like his random crit pitch. Yep. I had a great game with Stephen King. He was playing Zadesh 2, and he had a sentry come in. Or no, I was like, all right, I think I can get this assassination run. I have to get this sentry out of the way. So I walk up, and I'm like, Steve, I'm going to crit pitch this guy. So I roll the dice, get the crit. I throw him away. I'm an inch away. I crit pitch him 2 inches. And he goes, great, hyper-aggressive, and he walks back 2 inches. So I'm like, all right, let's do it again. So I get the crit pitch again, but he does it again. It's like, son of a bitch.
Yeah, works less good on steady models, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, that was quite fun.
Yeah, Mulg is, he's a really cool role player. You can do weird things, too, like one of the best features Bork has going is that he can cast an Animus for free every turn. Of any Northgin model, and all of the models in his battle group are automatically Northgin because of his Field Marshal. Which also means, like, Mulg is immune to cold. So, like, Juggernaut charges him, boosts to hit, hits Mulg, crit stationary, and you're like, nope, now Mulg hits you back. Goodbye, Juggernaut. So, again, like, really good into Cador, good into lots of bricks, good into big chunks of jacks. You've got Frosthammer. And Frosthammer, if Mulg tramples forward and does his Animus to give access to being used as an arc node, Borka can channel Frosthammers through him, which gives you like a really deep digging piece that can kind of let Borka pretend he's on both sides of the board. Like you can be really aggressive on the left side of the board, like charging in, hitting things with your bear, knocking them down, smacking things with your club, and casting the Lightning Troll Animus to get E-Leaps both off your impact attacks and also off your melee attacks so that you can kind of 2-for-1 clear infantry in a really impressive way. Meanwhile, while all of that is happening, you can also have Mulg turn into an Arc Node on the right side of the board and just be able to threaten pieces a little bit deeper. Just dig a little deeper with a key Frosthammer here or there. And it's one of the things I like about Bork is he feels like a caster who just does an enormous amount of work every turn and doesn't mind going down to a 1 or a 0 camp. You still can't kill him.
Yeah, he's still super hard to kill. So do you want to talk about, because I think this was asked, and you've talked about the Storm Troll a couple times, do you want to talk about why this is a good Signar answer?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I can definitely talk about that. So one of the boogeymen in Signar is obviously Nemo 3. The Nemo 3 matchup is very, very good for Borka, and there's a few reasons for that. One of them is simply that you just have 2 Earth Trolls.
Yep.
Earthborn is immune to lightning, which for the time being means simply Nemo's attacks don't do any damage to him at all. Even when we move to a CID change, if it's +4 armor, that makes the Earthborn conditionally armored 28 against lightning attacks, which means even something like POW 17 boosted damage rolls are going to do an average of 3 points of damage to him in attack. That's not good. That's you trading a Firefly, that's you positioned around countercharge, that's you shooting up a Storm Troll and you're using power tokens on your feed turn. So that is functionally a piece in the list that you cannot kill as Nemo. Borka, additionally, base armor 18 goes to armor 20 after he's been damaged and becomes armor 20 or 22 when he has the Stone Aura. He's defense 14, and he can cast for free every turn the Lightning Troll's Animus to also be immune to lightning. So what you end up with is Earthborn, Borka, Earthborn, all of whom can be immune to lightning and very, very aggressively positioned on the table with their conditional speed 7, sometimes speed 9. If you've got rush or access to rough terrain, speed 8 with repo 3 on Borka. Like, you've got pieces that can move really quickly up the board, and they can create a pocket in which you put Mulg behind them and block line of sight to him completely.
Yeah.
Which is it's very, very strong. It means you can deliver Mulg up the board, and eventually Mulg can go kill something like a Stormstrider, or can go trivially remove a couple Fireflies. Rock's a more vulnerable piece in the list, but if they have their feet to kill Rock and nothing else ever in the entire game, you win that matchup quite nicely.
And the fact that you have two heavies and your caster, who also does the work of a heavy that you can't do any damage to currently, I mean, that just, and that can get in your face fast enough, and that is a gun line they're going into. Arcane Vortex for any of the Force Hammers, like, there's just... Yep. It doesn't seem as bad when you first, like, oh, okay, there's three lightning immune things in there, and it's super bad. also, his feet's not really great for the Nemo 3 list either. Like, that's pretty bad.
So your feet gives you stealth,
yeah,
which is a big deal into a lot of traditional Signar guns. A lot of people, and it's very good into kind of melee-oriented heavy metal bricks or something like... something like Haley 2 lists that want to temp excel and send a Stormclad in on something, like the kind of list like Cray, where their goal is to just like ram into you really, really hard. Against melee lists, you can be like, okay, here I am comfortably in your threat ranges, but if you charge me, you lose a bunch of shit. And they're like, do I back out and cede scenario to you now, or do I move into your also pretty impressive threat ranges? Like, it becomes a bit of a Hobson's choice that's really awkward. But you might answer, Signar players, against traditional stealth skew answers, Nemo can just run a Firefly up and shoot it in the back and arc lightning into things like Mulg or Rock, and that's very challenging to screen against, especially with lightning immune models, which it will not jump to. Well, here comes why Borgus feat is really weird and awesome. The stationary effect applies to friendly faction models who are immune to cold in his control. The stealth element applies to models in his control.
Yep.
So if you run a Firefly, and I did have this happen, if you run a Firefly and feet and shoot that Firefly in the back, you miss because that Firefly has stealth.
Yep.
Which is weird.
Really fun.
and if it wasn't feet turn, you still have the possibility of that Firefly getting countercharged and totally correct. Fucked because it's just a light. And now you have to hit it in the back at defense, what, 17? Seems bad. 15?
Probably 15. I bet you have a back arc.
Still not
And
great.
You know what? Maybe the movement got crippled by the countercharge, so that's a win.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot worse on paper. And I'll let you, but into the Haley 3, you have Linus and Edria to bust up that cloud wall.
Yeah, Edria is really good. Now, a lot of conventional wisdom about, like, oh, I can beat Haley 3 because I can beat a cloud wall, that's not usually adequate. Like, she's got a lot of really impressive tools. However, to deal with things like her high defense, you've got access to Primal. You've got Rock, who's base mat 7, Mulg, who's base mat 7. You've got access to magical weapons in the form of Mulg. You've got the stone that removes incorporeal and stealth. So you've got, like, a lot of tools that once you open a lane into that brick, first of all, you're very fast. You're very aggressive up the table. So even assuming she goes first, she wants to protect herself well, so she has trouble capitalizing on a lot of table space. Additionally, as she's putting down the cloud wall every turn, it's difficult for her to hold a lot of table space while you're moving very, very quickly into it. If you get a moment where you can break a hole in the cloud wall with a Drea, you're often in a position where you can charge with something like an Earthborn that conceivably threats 13 inches. Your list is also quite resilient to the kind of guns she brings because you've got access to that stealth for a turn. And then when you get to a point in the game where she's like, well, I've got defense 15 infantry, and you're like, well, I've got mat 9 heavies, you're in a pretty strong position. Especially Rock, who can get into a brick of trenchers and need sixes to hit and have the capacity to make two initials and then buy 5 attacks, and he can just rip through everything in his melee range very, very incredibly.
Arcane Vortex also seems like a potentially bigger deal, just because the Haleys, even though they have a good amount of focus, they don't have a lot to throw around on having a spell get negated. So that can be a big deal.
If I was looking to play any one of these complex matchups, when's like the next convention I could do it?
Ha, good segue. Southern
worst.
Ontario Open. Which is, it's actually, it's what? Not
next
this weekend,
weekend,
but next weekend.
Yep.
Yeah, it's coming up real soon. That's my hometown convention. Matt Clark and I both worked to build it from a small event at a Legion Hall or a VFW for Americans. we built it from that with plywood tables that we sanded with some helpful locals and friends into what it is now, which is much, much larger and I'd argue pretty impressive. We're at the Sheridan in downtown Hamilton, which is a really nice venue, a huge ballroom, lots of rooms. We've got side events and vendors and all the sort of same stuff you come to expect from last year, an incredible library of board games, which is almost entirely Agatha and my collection of board games, but we've got some pretty impressive titles in that collection. I think it's it may be over 80 titles now, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
Including Secret Hitler, which we have now. I think 3 copies of between us.
Between the two of you?
Yeah.
Okay. Just clarifying.
Yeah. Collections. It's Matt and Agatha and I who are kind of part of most of the planning, but it's a real joint effort. We've got an incredible team of volunteers who are going to be helping to make it a thing, and we've got a lot of people coming from fairly far afield. I think I heard Brandon, a friend of the cast, is coming on, which is pretty cool. He'll be joining us, which is fun and exciting. And you guys are all driving up, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we'll all be up there.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I think it's gonna be a real blast. I have actually a couple things I can say about it. One of them is that I have the schedule. So if anyone is coming to that event and is excited about it, the schedule is probably gonna be posted pretty soon. And these things aren't per se locked in stone, but the Friday is going to be Champions. That's starting at 8. When I say starting at 8, I mean we're taking registration for Champions up until 8 a.m. At that point, if you haven't registered from 7 a.m. until 8 a.m., you've got that opportunity to come in. Open. Anybody can come. If you've got a ticket, you can sign up for it. We're not capping that event. We've seen success in the past. As long as you're there before 8 o'clock, you can come into the event, no problem. After 8 o'clock, we're reserving the right to not accept people because we have to coordinate how many tables we have and make sure that everything's put together pretty nicely.
Real quick, can we clarify the putting your lists on Conflict Chamber versus pre-registering for being at the event? Because I was a little confused about that as well.
Yeah, no worries. That's a really good question, Grant. We're using Conflict Chamber this year, and the links for that are on the Southern Ontario Facebook page. That's not sufficient to register. You need to come into the desk and check in with Agatha or Justin or myself, or Matt. I'll probably be doing that as well. But you have to come in, and you have to check in with us. That's the biggest thing, because we need to know that you're physically there. Sometimes you have people submit lists and then end up like, you know, having some car trouble and not being able to make it to the event until like a day later. And we don't want to be looking around the room trying to find you. Come in, check in, have your list already typed up for the Conflict Chamber thing, and we can have a copy for you. That makes list validation and it makes registration much, much easier. If that 8 a.m. on a Friday is not your cup of tea, we also have 8-player scrambles. They'll be firing starting at 11 o'clock, and the Iron Arena will be open, I believe, also at 8 a.m., so that'll be available the entire time. We're opening the Hobby Lounge at 9 a.m. That's open basically till 8 p.m. that night. The Hobby Lounge is something that we added last year. It's been really successful. We've got James Craig, who is fresh off some crystal brush judging at Adepticon, really incredible painter. Also, Ben Carver is going to be there. He's done some beautiful work, which you've actually featured on my channel. But he's done some really beautiful work. He's coordinating the Hobby Lounge, and a good friend of mine, Kaz, who painted my troll army, which is really, really pretty. It's actually, I mean, if we're being frank, it's his troll army. I'm just borrowing it for the year. He's there, and he'll be teaching some classes, I think, on two-brush blending in the evening on Friday. So it's a really, really fun experience, and if you don't want to play in Champions or scrub out of Champions or are there just to hang out and to do some other stuff, get involved in some of that. It was a really cool room last year. We had set up through most of the weekend. People could hang out in, paint, assemble some models, kind of just sort of shoot the shit and work on some painting stuff, or take some stuff that you've painted that you're particularly proud of or that you want some critiques on and go to some master-level painters and say, like, what do you think of this? Or what kind of color should I be using here? Or do you have any recommendations? That's been really cool in the past. We also have 9 a.m. on Friday. We have our first Guild Ball flight firing. I believe that one may have a player capacity of 16. Last year, we were pretty happy with how the Guild Ball turned out, and we're planning to run more of it this year as well. And the same group we had last year running Iron Kingdoms RPG, they're going to have a limited sign-up. They're going to fire an event at noon and then another one at 6 p.m. Those are like a sort of small module for a limited table of players. Those ones are going to be sign-up on-site, so everyone has the same crack at it, but they are going to be capped once they fill up those slots. So that's what Friday's about. I know you gentlemen, I think, is everyone going to be here for Friday?
Yeah, yes. We will be up Thursday afternoon. Cool. All of us.
If you want to come and hang out, I think we're going to have everything set up Thursday night. Last year we got everything set up, got all of our tables organized, and then went to see a movie together, which was really cool.
Sweet.
But if you're into it, you know, many hands make light work sort of thing. So if you're keen, I know that for folks who are doing volunteering, I've got some stuff, dice and t-shirts based on the amount of volunteering you want to do over the course of the weekend. So I've already had a couple of people talk to me about that. But if more people are interested and you're coming to the Sioux and you're like, yeah, I don't mind spending a day helping out, like, feel free to send me a message and we'll make sure that you get involved in the sort of volunteering that you want to do. I also know that one of the hallmarks of the Southern Ontario Open is that we always do overnight events. Try to make sure that you can kind of game until you literally run out of energy completely. Iron Arena will be open all night, and then starting at 7 p.m. for registration and 8 for actual dice rolling, we're going to be doing an overnight event, which I believe is the two-headed dragon team tournament style event. That's basically you play as a duo. Each person has their own list and it can be in their own theme or their own caster, and you play simultaneous turns on a fairly limited clock against another duo of players. I believe that's 35 points plus battle group, which is it's always a fun and wild event.
I've never played in one of those. I'm excited. I actually want to do that this year.
Yeah.
What,
yeah.
The overnight events?
Yeah.
The twin dragon or double-headed dragon or whatever it's called.
Double-headed, yeah. I'm definitely losing some sleep on that one.
Yeah, no, it's a sweet event. Actually, they had it at Adepticon this year, and Keith opted to play in that over playing in Champions because it's just such a fun event. I know they lost in the finals of that event with, like, Magnus 2 Kruger 2 or something crazy like that. Like, just this absurd control pairing. But there's some really fun lists. Evan and I played it together at War Machine Weekend this year, and I was like, you've got your Makeda Cats list, right? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, you take a unit of cats, I'll take a unit of cats, you take some Arcadons, I'll take some Arcadons, you play Makeda with all the rest of the support she needs, and I'll play Jalam as a super solo. So he played his full Makeda list into people, and then at some point I was like, I'll feat too, and now you can't kill anything.
Oh my god.
It was pretty fun. Again, there is a late-night IKRPG module, and then on Saturday is the Southern Ontario Open. So it's an Open Masters, which means there's one heat that qualifies people for day two. It's a trio-style event, Trinity event, that's the term I'm looking for, which means it's three lists, because Masters is still DNC 1 over the course of between 7 and 8 rounds, which we'll announce at the beginning of the tournament based on the number of players. You need to play each list at least once. That means the overwhelming majority of people don't have to think about it as a DNC event at all, because only the top 8 people are going to make day 2. Those people have to be conscious of their DNC, because you have to play each list once by the end of the 7th or 8th round, which again we'll announce. We'll be doing between 4 and 5 rounds on the first day, and then we'll be doing rounds either 5 through 7 or 6 through 8 on Sunday.
So an X and 1 can qualify for day 2 and then still win the event?
Yes. So the way that it works is while your DNC is based on the two-day event, you are the sort of schedule of players is reset for the second day, and it's run as like as if it was an eight-player tournament with the same lists and the same DNC rules. It's a little bit... it's motivated largely by the notion that we want people to feel a need to kind of jockey for it, and there's a possibility that you could still make it in with an X and 1 record, and we want people who make day 2 to have a motivation to play day 2 and win the best they can. Saturday also has another Guild Ball flight, again starting about an hour after the Masters event starts. Our aim is to have people registering for Masters starting at 8, and to have Masters officially starting before 10 o'clock. Again, if you do not have your check in to the desk and registration by 9 a.m. on Saturday, we will not guarantee you a spot in the event.
Does that count as me just like messaging Aggie and saying I'm here?
You have to physically line up, and you have to come to the desk.
Fine.
And you have to check in.
Fine.
That's the thing.
Pro
messages
tip about,
are insufficient.
Pro tip about check-in, make sure you put your name on your list.
Yeah.
You don't want to be the guy.
I hear that helps. That,
you don't want to be the guy that poor Naughty is running around going, who's playing Baldur 1? And, you know, and you're like, oh, that's me. I'm a dumbass. Yeah.
You also don't want to get caught trying to slip a list in the middle of the pile.
I don't know anything about that, but
don't do that.
I hear that's bad for the people that try to do that.
Correct. We'll be running a surprise mystery overnight event on Saturday, a mystery deathmatch event, which I'll announce some more details about later. Don't want to spoil the end. I'm hoping to actually get some enthusiasm for it the day of. Should be a lot of fun. And then on Sunday, we had a lot of requests to have more events on Sunday, especially for people who don't make the cut for Masters. So we will be running the second inaugural Privateer Press caster draft.
Oh, shit.
The first one was run at Adepticon, and it was pretty wild. Basically, the premise is you build a list minus a caster with a certain restricted number of battle group points. And we'll post some more details about this later. But you build that list, and then you don't bring a caster. You bring instead just a small base model for that works for your faction, some kind of a caster or model that could represent a caster. And then you pass around a number of cards that have advantages, or they have rules, or they have spells, or they have like plus one armor or plus one focus. And from a base template, you draft the rules of your caster. And it's like spell draft on crack. It's a really, really fun event. It's been playtested internally by Privateer Press, and we're treating this as a little bit of an open beta. We're taking feedback from the players who participated at the Southern Ontario Open, and we're passing that on directly to Will Hungerford, who has generously provided us the cards for this event. And it's going to be pretty wild. So don't make plans to bail on Sunday if you don't want to miss out on what I think is probably going to be the coolest event of the weekend.
And I don't know where it's posted, but somewhere they posted the picture of the stats for the person who won. And if you want to get hyped for this event, just go look at that, because it was fucking ridiculous, but looks amazing. So
yeah, it should be really, really good. I'm excited about it.
I'm super excited for that.
I will acknowledge to anybody who who's anxious about it for any reason, I will not be playing in any of the events this year. I mean, it's possible I'll play a couple of Iron Arena games or play some Secret Hitler or board games, but I will certainly not be playing in the Southern Ontario Open Masters this year. I'm going to be full-time judging this round. My hope is, if everything's running smoothly, as it was last year, I'll have the opportunity to let Matt or Agatha play in the Masters. If they want to, of course.
Are you going
to
play in the caster draft?
Everything is contingent on how smoothly things are running.
Sure.
Last year we were really lucky and everything was running great, and there were no problems, which meant I got to say, like, awesome, I'll get to play in a game.
I'll just win Masters. No big deal.
I'll just win everything.
Yeah.
It's about running a good show, and our priority number one is that we get to deliver a good experience to everybody who's attending, and priority number two is any kind of enjoyment we want to take out of the event.
Yeah. And I know we've said this a million times, but you certainly did that. I mean, we went one time and propelled to the top of our con list. We're like, well, we're going this no matter what happens, so mark this on the schedule. So we are super excited. Brad just randomly messaged me the other day. He's like, hey. I'm like, what's up, buddy? You're everything okay? He's like, oh, yeah, I'm just getting hyped for the Sioux. Just want to talk to somebody about it. I'm like, yes, let's do it. So
that may have happened.
Yeah. So, Tim, thanks for coming on. We are going to wrap up. Thanks for the great analysis on the troll, on your Masters and Champions runs, and then the troll list themselves, because it is just, it's so much more in-depth than what it first looks at. It exceeds the eye test, I guess, right?
Yeah, you can't go at first glance.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me chat about it, folks. And if anybody has any questions about it or comments or thoughts or feedback, I'm always open to that kind of thing. You can message me on Facebook. I pop into the War Machine Discord from time to time. You can contact me via Arcane Assist. We handle comments on YouTube. I usually respond to those pretty quickly. And you can also message our Facebook page or email us at arcaneassistpodcast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Check them out. Check out Not Snakes Gaming. And you can, if you have any questions about the Sioux, you can go to the page and message, and the great folks there will get back to you if there's any questions about the registrations or anything like that. And I think that's everything. Tim, excited to see you next week, buddy. We're really looking forward to it. It's going to be awesome.
Should be a lot of fun. Make sure we get a meal.
Absolutely. I think we'll wrap it up. We may record next week. We might take the week off because we're going to, we'll be doing Sioux, but we'll see. We might even bring the stuff and try to get a recording at the Sioux.
You know what you will do?
What will we
do? The State of the Union podcast.
Oh, we will certainly. If we're invited, we will certainly do that.
You will. Did you catch it last year?
Oh, I did. I did catch it last year. It was excellent.
We were definitively not invited, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that was deliberate. A lot of people who they just kind of like couldn't get into the room quickly enough were not there. I know that like Evan didn't make it in because he's like, I don't even know that was happening at that time. Yeah. Like some people left for dinner. So this time it's a little bit better advertised. And we've got a lot of people who are involved in the podcasting community. And I think it's definitely our hope to have everybody there who has had a voice or an interest in the War Machine community and been part of the kind of community outreach components of it to be able to be there and to talk. It's one of the best received experiences that I think the Beer Machine and Mush Machine guys have put together, and I know they're definitely doing it again this year. I'm very excited to participate in it, and just to hear the exchange of ideas.
Yes,
it's well moderated too. I will give credit where it's due. Rich produces and is again from the Beer Machine podcast. He produces the soundboarding and the audio and all of those things, and they're second to none. But Will from Mush Machine has considerable experience moderating it and does a very good job of it. I definitely felt like well reined in from time to time, and I know I have the tendency to ramble.
It was very well done, and I felt the same way when I listened to it. I thought he did an excellent job. I could not moderate that many people that well, for sure.
Grant, yes, you could.
All right.
Yeah, man, you're like our superstar, man. That's, you hit the big leagues. You got that's us right. invited to this whole thing.
Sure. Sure, sure.
Speaking of podcasts, make sure you tune in to Fear the Swan, featuring our very own Grant Ritchie Cole Westbrook and my favorite Signar player, Anthony Gibbs. Mm-hmm. And then you guys have a special fourth person coming on, and we'll let you reveal that on the podcast.
Yep. We got our fourth person, and we'll be recording tomorrow night, and that we'll let that get revealed there. But we're excited for who we're bringing on.
Also, we're doing Fully Boosted versus Arcane Assist at the Sioux, right?
Yep. Yeah, because Pete decided that was a good idea, so I get to go get my ass kicked.
Winning team gets free dinner from the losing team.
Yeah, I think that's what was settled. Can we bring in a ringer? Like, can I send in, like, Ireland and Brandon? Can I do a tag? No? Okay.
No. Yeah, you have to play your
You have to win a game.
I just edit podcasts, guys.
You
That's
what,
all
Grant?
I do with
we'll
my
We'll let
life.
You pick which of the four of us you want to play against. You've got, well, I'm playing Brad. That's obviously.
Yeah, that's a given. Yeah, that's a locked in.
But you can play against either Evan or Jason or John.
Oh, I want Jason for sure. Let's go.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know what?
Well, we're down a game.
What's your smack talk? What are you going to say? Like, give me some good trash talk.
I don't have any. I'm just
for Jason. Come on, Jason. No. Trash talks everyone all the time.
I know he talks mad shit.
You gotta have some shit talk for Jason.
I'll message him privately and talk a lot of shit. Yeah,
he's
that's,
just a dumb ogre. Look at him.
I mean, see, Brad's got good shit talk. Yeah. Come on, Grant. You gotta step this up.
I got By nothing.
Soon,
I'm just
I expect some good shit talk.
All right, I'll have something ready. I'm excited for an elk burger at the works with Jason. That's all I got right now.
Tim's cosplaying as a Texas Raider from Scar 3's boat.
Nice. Yeah. Did you
this all the time?
Real quick.
He shaves his head at least.
And this is gonna suck for everybody that's not listening. But did you notice Brad's Skype picture, Tim?
No, I did not.
Because it's great, and I'm probably gonna grab that picture if Brad will send it to me, and I'm gonna use that as the tag for this podcast episode.
All right, I'm into it.
Yeah. Because it's great, and I can never get enough of that picture.
What even is that?
It's the picture of you staring lovingly at Brad from across the room.
Oh, that's pretty great.
The picture's hot.
Like, get you a girl who'll look at you like Tim stares at Brad.
That's right.
And photo sent.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited. All right, let's wrap it up, guys. We went on for a long time. Tim, thanks again. So excited to see you next week, buddy. And that's it. I'm Grant.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Brad.
I'm Pete McWaters. You better have my rings.
Watch, he's like lent them to somebody else at this point.
Yeah. They're gone. They're gone. They're gone for sure.
First through fourth best players in Montreal.
Perfect. All right. Thanks for listening.